Patrick Rothfuss is a Wisconsin Renaissance man. He hosts Symposia in his home. He writes a satirical humor column, and he spent 9 years getting his undergraduate degree, using the time to study everything from philosophy to Eastern theater. During that time, he wrote book one of the King Killer trilogy called The Name of the Wind that earned him accolades from the writing world and landed him on the New York Times bestseller list. Well, Patrick is back in Wisconsin now, fresh from book tour, for The Wise Man's Fear, book two of the trilogy. And these days, he's a bit of a literary rock star. His blog gets thousands of hits a day, and his new book recently hit number one on the Times bestseller list. And Patrick Rothfuss drove down from Stevens Point to join me in the studio today, and we'll be talking about what makes fantasy novels work, life as a Wisconsin writer, and what it takes to build a better fantasy world. And we welcome your questions and comments, as we always do, at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@wpr.org, and you can also join in on our Facebook page for the Veronica Rickard Show. And Patrick Rothfuss, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for getting here in one piece. You told us before the show started that you drove so fast, you were almost driving backwards.
I will admit I'm not much of a morning person, and more importantly, it's hard for me to get away from my baby in the morning, so got on the road a little bit late, and I don't think it's legal for me to actually tell you publicly how fast I was driving to get down here on time.
How old is the baby?
He just turned a year and a half.
A year and a half. Congratulations.
Yeah. He just figured out how to say daddy and please. And when he puts those two things together, It's hard to walk away.
You're in trouble now.
Yeah.
I wonder what that means for your writing life. Are you still getting as much writing done?
Well, I've known for a while that I need to get out of the house and away from potential distractions to get any good work done. So luckily I'm already set up to escape that. Nothing's as hard to get away from as the baby.
Mm, yeah, they've got a hold on you.
Yeah.
A writer's best and worst friend.
Exactly.
Well, you're just back from book tour for your second book in the King Killer trilogy. This one's called The Wise Man's Fear. What was tour like this time?
Oh, man. Well, this was really my only tour. I've done signings before and, you know, done conventions and events, but this was the first honest-to-goodness book tour, and nobody really expected it to be as big as it was. We were hoping, you know, hoping to get 100 or 200 people at some of these events. I was fearing that we would get maybe two or three dozen because they go through a lot of work and expense to fly me around to these places. And the bookstores order in books. And I actually had nightmares about it before the tour started, that I would show up and, like, nobody would come to my signing. I never had those high school anxiety dreams. But I definitely had some anxiety dreams about this tour. But then I showed up in Seattle for the first one, and there were like 500-600 people there.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. They couldn't almost fit in the store.
Wow. Yeah. I guess you've made it, huh?
I can't deny it anymore. I've kind of made it.
Well, that's awesome. You said on your blog that you had some road stories to tell. Do you want to share any here?
Oh, wow. Yeah. I haven't gotten around to actually posting them up on the blog yet, because I've been so busy digging through my backlog of email. Boy, I don't even know where to start. I met a person who had tattooed my signature onto her arm. That was in Portland.
Wow. That's a fan.
I didn't believe it, honestly. She goes, look what I did. And I looked, and it was my signature, and it was on the inside of her forearm. And I'm like, and I just laughed. I'm like, that's really, what? Really? No. Really? And I had to touch it to actually feel that it was real before I believed her.
Was that a good thing, or did it freak you out a little?
Well, you know, it caught me so off guard that, I mean, it's undeniably flattering. But that's a little bit of pressure, too. I'm glad I didn't know about it working on book two, because she must have gotten that done just based off only the first book. And that's a lot of trust to put in a person who's only written one book. If the second one had sucked, I mean, she's going to have to invest in pancake makeup for a long time, or maybe just burn it off. But yeah, it was me on one arm and Jim Butcher on the other. And that was, it was a little odd.
Well, let's talk about your books a little bit for people who haven't read them. As we said, the second one, the second one, The Wise Man's Fear, is number one on the New York Times bestseller list right now. And that's huge for you. But it's the first one, I think, didn't hit number one, but it did make the list.
It did make the list when it came out in paperback, yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit about the world you've created and your hero, Kvothe.
Well, you know, it's kind of hard to talk about the world in general terms. I always kind of joke about it, where building the world has been my hobby, which is the only reason I can justify the amount of obsessive detail that I've put into it. If I was just making the world so that I could write the book in it, I wouldn't spend nearly the amount of time on it that I do. As it is, it's acceptable to have an obsessive amount of time put into a hobby, like people that make model railroads, you know, or people that do gardening, or people that, any hobby, really, you put so much time and energy into it because you love it and it kind of relaxes you. And so that's what I've done making this world. I work really hard to make it a very realistic place, and all the pieces fit together, and all of the cultures have some substance to them, and the economy would actually work. The myths and the stories of the people in this world, I know a lot of those things. And I think that, you know, I mostly do it because it's fun, but as an added benefit, it gives me a really fun sandbox to write these stories in. And it gives the story, I think, kind of a sense of depth that you don't have if you're kind of just like building a, you know, one of those plywood fronted movie sets,
right?
You know, like those old Westerns used to have.
And readers can sense those plywood fronted movie set backdrops.
Exactly. You really can. Sometimes you read a book and it can be a fun book, but it's not something you really feel like there's more to the world than you're being told. I used to talk about it at conventions, and I mentioned it once on the blog, and somebody said, how much of the world do you actually show us? I'm like, well, you know, probably out of every 100 things I know about the world, 5 might end up in the book. And somebody goes, you know, and there's a bunch of comments, and somebody goes, oh, Hemingway's Iceberg. And I'm like, what? And he goes, yeah, Hemingway said that about 10% of what an author does ends up in the actual book, and the rest is below the surface, like an iceberg. And I go, well, damn, you know, I thought I was doing this kind of in my own obsessive way, but apparently I'm like Hemingway.
Well, and the person who comes to mind with me is J.R.R. Tolkien. He spent years constructing that world, and he wrote history for it. He wrote a language for it, an actual functioning language.
Yeah.
He's big into languages. And I guess he's sort of the gold standard for fantasy writers, isn't he?
He really is. I always think of him as Granddaddy Tolkien. You know, everybody who reads fantasy knows about Tolkien. He has such a deep footprint, it'd probably be better to say he casts a really long shadow. If you're writing secondary world fantasy, by which I mean fantasy not set in this world, but in a second, different world, then it's hard to avoid Tolkien's shadow.
Yeah, well, I guess you can say he's got a shadow, but you also have to tip your hat for
absolutely
jump-starting the genre. And I know you're a fan, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I read them once a year, every year, all through high school, through a lot
once
of
once a year, every year.
Oh, sure. You have nothing but time when you're in high school.
Oh, wow. So you're a total Tolkien nerd.
I'm a dyed-in-the-wool geek in more ways than you can ever know.
Well, tell us, we talked a little bit about the world and how you set it up, but just to give some ideas of the components of this, you've got magic in this world, and you've got a certain kind of deep magic, which involves the naming of things. You've got a university that has a lot of importance in the novels. What else strikes you about this world?
Well, the big thing is everything should be in service to the story. Sometimes what happens a lot when somebody writes a fantasy novel is they spend so much time making the world, or they make a religion, or they make a magic system. And then since they're excited about that, they spend all their time trying to to tell you about the world, sort of like a new mom. You know, you have the baby, and then you end up talking to the mom, and the mom, of course, is going to want to tell you all about what the baby did today and all what the baby did yesterday. The problem is, it's mostly interesting to the mom and only tangentially interesting to other people.
Right.
And that's the same thing, you know, when a fantasy author has made a world. I mean, I could talk to you about the currency systems, you know, which I've really developed, and they're based in the history of some of these cultures. At I was doing a tiny, tiny little reading once, and somebody said, oh, you know, I heard you actually have this whole currency developed for this other world. Could you tell us about that? I'm like, nah, you don't want to hear about it. There were only a dozen people there. And everyone kind of nodded. They go, yeah, we would like to hear about it. I'm like, you really don't want to hear about it. And they said, yes. So I talked for half an hour about wow. how this currency system was developed, and how it was rooted in like the feudal system that they used to have. And I mean, they were interested, but that was a very rare audience. I warn you, asking me too much about the world, you're going to get me started. It's just like asking me about my baby. I'll tell you stories, but I don't know if all of those things were really, really, truly interesting. I would have put them in the book. Mostly, they're my own personal little stories.
That is something people have noticed, though. I've read reviews where people talk about how you'll mention a one-off, a coin in Kvothe's pocket, and it's clear that there's some backstory there, but you don't get it. But it's cool to know that it's there, nonetheless.
Yeah, I'd always rather tell you a little bit and have you wish that I told you more than to tell you so much and have you be bored. It's sort of the classic guest philosophy. You don't want to stick around someone's house until they want you to leave. You want to leave early when they want you to stay. That's my storytelling philosophy, too.
I want to give our listeners a little taste of what your writing sounds like. Now, this is the very beginning of the very first book, and obviously a ton happens after this. But just to set the stage a little, here we go.
It was night again. The Waystone Inn lay in silence, and it was a silence of three parts. The most obvious part was a hollow, echoing quiet made by things that were lacking. If there had been a wind, it would have sighed through the trees, set the inn sign creaking on its hooks, and brushed the silence down the road like trailing autumn leaves. If there had been a crowd, even a handful of men inside the inn, they would have filled the silence with conversation and laughter, the clatter and clamor one expects from a drinking house during the dark hours of night. If there had been music, but no. Of course, there was no music. In fact, there were none of these things, and so the silence remained.
As the very beginning of your first book, I'm sure you recognize it.
It's so weird to hear somebody else's voice reading that. That's one of the pieces I've read maybe 100 times in public. Mm-hmm. And it is. It's so different. It's like hearing your voice on the answering machine. It's just interesting.
Surreal.
To hear. Yeah.
Well, we've been talking about how you create worlds and how you make them consistent and deep. And, you know, there's a lot of people out there who say, I just won't read fantasy. Some people just have a bee in their bonnet about fantasy. It's not something that's worthy literature. And, you know, you can remember when the Lord of the Rings movies were out, there was a lot of cultural conversation about, did these deserve to be considered great literature or not? Some people said yes, some people said no way. And same with J.K. Rowling, although I think the case, you know, is a little different there. But what about creating fantasy worlds that stand up to readers who are reading really intently? Do you think there's a trick to creating fantasy that passes muster as literature?
Well, boy, the whole literature discussion, it's an interesting discussion because through discussing that issue, you actually tend to stumble into the topic of what actually literature is. And anybody who's ever had that discussion realizes that once you try to define it, you realize you can't. It's one of those things that most people say, oh, I know it when I see it. Mm. And a lot of people try to convince me. One very good friend that works at the university that I used to know as a student said, you know, you really don't write fantasy, you write literature. And And I go, well, no, I write fantasy. You know, there's magic. It's a different world. It's fantasy. And she goes, but it's really good. And I'm like, yeah, I know. But just because a book is good doesn't mean that I'm writing literary fiction. I can write a fantasy novel that's really good. That's a big kind of misapprehension, that just because something, you're either writing genre fiction, which is a horror novel or a fantasy novel or a mystery or a romance, you're either doing one of those things or you're writing literature. And that's just not true. That's like saying, I mean, literature has elements of the fantastic in it. Literature has elements of mystery in it. I mean, half of Shakespeare's plays are full of magic and ghosts, and, you know, the Odyssey and the Iliad are full of gods and spells and witches. Those are literature. Pretty much the problem is, if people had been writing fantasy novels for the last 400 years and they'd been British, you know, and they were dead and white, you know, then fantasy would be literature now. The reason it's easier to swallow Tolkien is because, you know, he is dead and those books are older and he was British and he was an Oxford scholar. So right. We can nod at that and go, oh, literature.
But even him.
Yeah.
Some people debate it.
Oh, people debate it all the time. But there's no distinction. There's just good books and bad books, books that you like and books that you don't. And those are two, there's all different categories. Very different.
So I wonder about why you chose the novel, because you're clearly someone who draws from a whole bunch of different sources. I've seen you in with a Joss Whedon t-shirt on. You know, he's the guy who did Buffy.
Yeah.
Everyone loves Buffy. And there's D&D role-playing games, and there's online fantasy games. What made you pick the novel?
Well, I grew up reading novels for the most part. I really don't read many short stories. I mean, I read Bradbury back in the day, and nobody writes a better short story than Bradbury. But mostly growing up, all the way through middle school and high school and most of college, I read about a novel a day, and the vast majority of it was fantasy. You know, some science fiction, but mostly fantasy. And so when I think about telling a story, I think about it in novel terms. Occasionally now, because over the last 10-15 years I've read more graphic novels, very rarely I'll have an idea for a story and now I think of it in terms of graphic novels or in terms of an illustrated story, like a picture book. I did a picture book a while back that looks like a children's story, but it's really not. It's more like a dark fairy tale.
Well, we're talking this hour with Patrick Rothfuss. He's a Wisconsin native from Stevens Point, and he is the best-selling author of The Wise Man's Fear, which just came out, and its sequel, The Name of the Wind. Or actually, I've got the reverse, don't I? Sorry about that. It's the birth of the new one. Let's get this straight. The new one is called The Wise Man's Fear, and the first was The Name of the Wind. This is book two we're talking about today. And we're welcoming your phone calls this morning, too, for Patrick Rothfuss. What do you think about creating believable fantasy worlds? Do you think that they need to be deep and thought out, like Patrick's are, as we've been talking about this morning? What feeds you about reading fantasy like this? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Ricker, keeping you company this Friday morning here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we are delighted this morning to be joined in the studio with best-selling Wisconsin author Patrick Rothfuss. He drove down from Stevens Point today, and we're talking about his new book, the second in the Kingkiller trilogies. It's called The Wise Man's Fear. And we've got some callers already, so let's go and take Peter. He's joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Peter.
Hello, Veronica. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great. And Patrick, it's a privilege to talk to you.
Hey, Peter.
And I just wanted to say that, Patrick, I picked up your book in 2009, and I had steered away from fantasy after my teen years and gotten into quote-unquote serious literature, and then I read your book. And suffice it to say that I was pulled back into the fantasy genre. I just wanted to say that the fantasy genre personally, I think is like 98% crap. But I think that's true of pretty much any genre. That being said, your book took me back into the genre, introduced me to the Joe Abercrombies of the world, the George R.R. Martins of the world, and the serious writers that are out there in this genre. And I just have to say one other further thing, Patrick, that after I read your book, pretty much once a week I would do a Google search to find out when your next book was coming out. And then this last month I was having some personal issues, so I wasn't doing Google searches. But I called in to NPR one day because they had a Milwaukee bookstore owner in studio, and I called in because I just finished reading Jack Vance's Lioness Trilogy, which, if you haven't read it, Patrick, you need to. But and I was just telling them how wonderful this author, who not a lot of people know about, is. And he said that, well, there's a big buzz right now about Patrick Rothfuss's book. And I'm like, I'm sorry, what? when did it get released? And he said, well, last week. And I'm like, I'm on my way. I hung up the phone. And I had to go to Barnes & Noble's. I couldn't go to the local bookstore because they didn't have your book, unfortunately. But I read it, Patrick, and I just have to thank you from the bottom of my heart for doing what you're doing. I want to congratulate you on the addition to your family, and I just think that you are just incredible.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter. I'm guessing Peter might also be someone who's got your name tattooed on his arm. That was a nice call. Thank you so much for that. And, you know, it raises an interesting point. You know, with your first book, you came onto the scene and you were this unknown author. And the second one, you already had fans and you had, I assume, if Peter's any judge, a lot of people breathing down your neck for book two. How do you deal with the pressure like that when you've had this beautiful time to just sort of nurture the first one in your own silence and peace? What was different about book two?
It was a whole different world. You think that, you know, I worked on that first book for 14 years, and you'd think that after that, you know, finally I was published and people really wanted to read the next book. And so you'd think it would be like really easy to step from a kind of hobby writer into professional writer. And it really wasn't. Mm. It's really hard to make the adjustment mentally, because it used to be that the book was something that I did when I should be doing something else. You know, I should be studying, I should be reading for my classes, I should be getting some sleep. But that's what you do with your hobby. Your hobby is the thing you spend time on to relax. But then suddenly to have that hobby become your day job, it sounds like a dream come true. And in some ways it is. I am very lucky. But at the same time, you end up having to make this huge mental adjustment. Think of it like this. If a friend of mine who kind of went through a similar mental adjustment, his name of Tobias Buckel, he writes fantasy and sci-fi too. He told me he's been reading up on this psychological phenomenon where a lot of people go from striving artist to successful artist and just kind of screws them up mentally. Mm-hmm. And I was glad to hear that, because I was worried it was just me. And he said, if you take like a bunch of cardboard tubes and some tape and some glue and you put them in a room with some kids, the kids will have like a great time and they'll build stuff and they'll make weapons and forts and whatever. But then if you do the same thing, except beforehand, you take the kids and you say, you know, I'm going to give you $3 and I need you to go in there and make something for me. The kids will kind of go in and they'll do something for maybe like 10 minutes. And then like they want to get out of there. They want their $3 and they want to like leave and go play. Mm-hmm. Because suddenly you've made this a job. Suddenly they're responsible for something. And that's not fun. Fun is something you do because you want to do it. Work is something you do because you have to do it. And so that was a huge mental adjustment. And knowing that so many people like this first book so much, it really gave me a huge chunk of performance anxiety. I had some people, you know, send me emails saying that they love the book so much, and people named their children after characters in the book and all of this stuff. And I'm like, well, boy, no pressure. How am I supposed to deal with that?
Kind of makes you sympathize more with J.K. Rowling, too. And I know there were times when she felt rushed, where people were rushing her, at least on one of her books. Do you feel like that, too? Like you had to crank it out?
At first, I did. Luckily, I had a very, very experienced and kind editor, because I was going to try to get the book out in a year. So it would have been out in 2008. And I sent her the actual draft that I had, and I had 4 more months to finish the draft. We were going to meet our original publication deadline. And so I sent her the draft, and like a week later she calls me and she's like, this is pretty rough. I mean, there were some whole chapters that were just like a set of parentheses saying, and then this happens here. And I'm like, mm-hmm. I can do it. I know I can do it. I just, you know, I can spend 14 hours a day writing and I can get it done. I promised people that it'd be out in a year. She's like, this is really rough, and there's some parts that really need to be expanded, and you really haven't done a lot of revision on it yet. And I'm like, I can do it. I know I can do it. I'm really... And it went on like that for about 5 minutes, and then finally she said, I'm pulling the book out of production. Because at that point, it was already being advertised as it would be on sale. It was in the catalog. And she goes, I'm pulling it out of production. And I felt this huge wave of relief, and I said, oh, thank God. And then... she gave me like years more to work on it and actually expand the book and revise it and show it to people and get feedback. So I could have done it in a year and it would have been at best an okay book, but she really gave me time to write a book that I'm proud of, like what I think is a really great book. It's every bit as good as The Name of the Wind.
Well, that's a relief. Sounds like a wise editor there. And, you know, I suppose it would be tempting to get into that all-nighter mentality where you've got a term paper due the next morning. You'll do what it takes to get it out there. But when you're a writer, that's probably the last thing you want to do because it's out there forever.
Exactly. Well, and that's what another author told me. He himself is known for missing some deadlines. And he said, you know... He goes, the book is late once, but it would suck forever. And I'm like, wow, that's a great way of thinking about it. I don't want this second book to be out there sucking forever.
Right, that's a good bumper sticker. All right, let's take another call. Josh, joining us from Kentucky. Hi, Josh.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm going good. How about you?
I'm doing pretty well. Kind of surprised I got through, actually.
Oh, I'm glad to have your call.
I actually had two things to say. Patrick, we met in Lexington, Kentucky. I'm the zombie guy.
Hey!
I wanted to say, on behalf of all of us who are really, really big fans, and I'm through my third reading of Wise Man's Fear right now, that take your time. We're willing to wait another 3 or 4 years for the book.
That's nice to hear.
My question, actually, you partially answered in Lexington, but I wanted to know, you said that you had considered writing other things in the Four Corners world, but were you intending on using any of the characters, maybe the secondary characters, or were you going to do a whole new set?
Well, I am definitely planning on telling more stories in this world. I kind of built it to be big enough to hold a bunch of stories. You know, you mentioned Tolkien before, and the thing is, Tolkien's story was so big that by the end of The Lord of the Rings, like, for example, The Hobbit was a very small story that happened in the world. And so he could tell another story after The Hobbit. But The Lord of the Rings, the story was so big that it effectively used up his world. You couldn't ever write The Lord of the Rings 2. Hmm. It just doesn't work. You've already had, like, armies clashing and the world has changed so much through the course of the story that you almost have to reinvent everything just to write it. You know, like the elves are leaving, magic is fading, you know, everything is changing in that world. He effectively burned through that world to finish the trilogy. But I didn't want to accidentally do that myself, since the story I'm telling is mostly about a man's life. There's plenty of other stories. There's plenty of other people in the world. So I don't know. There will definitely be some of the same characters in that, in later stories and later books that I do in the Four Corners world. Mm. But more than that, I will not say at this point.
It's an interesting way to think about it, about burning up all of your backstory before you know, you might want to use it in the future, too. And one thing that's interesting about your book is that this is told from a particular point of view. You know, Lord of the Rings, of course, is everybody's point of view. You're following everyone in the third person. Not so with your book. It feels a lot more intimate, I think, because of that. What made you pick that?
You know, people give me more credit than I deserve. They're like, wow, this was a very innovative choice and very risky and, well, you know, to do it in first person. But I never really thought that. There's a lot of good books that are written in third person. Joan Vinge's Scion is a brilliantly good book. And it's all first person. But because you're right, it gives you a much more intimate view of a character. It gives you a much more emotional view on a story. But there's a ton of first-person books out there. And really, if you think about it, the whole tradition of this third-person novel, I think that's something that just got kicked off in the Victorian era, and it kind of became tradition. But it's not a natural storytelling form. You know, I don't come and sit down to lunch with you and say, I was just outside and you sit down and go, oh man, guess what just happened? I was over here. I saw this. I did this. That's the most primal, basic storytelling thing that we have available to us. That's how we all start telling stories. Why wouldn't I use that in a novel?
Let's get to another phone call. Mary is joining us next from Appleton. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. I really enjoyed your book, and thanks for writing it. My whole family's enjoyed it. I've got 4 kids, and everybody's reading all your books, so thanks a lot for that.
Well, thank you.
I noticed in this book that Quoth could do no wrong, that he succeeds at everything, and I'm just wondering, how do you balance a believable character with that much success?
Oh, God, I don't know. You finished the whole book? of Wise Man's Fear?
Yes.
Boy, I don't know if he succeeds at everything. You might want to take a closer read. Quoth makes terrible mistakes all the time. He's very good at a lot of things. But here's the tricky thing is a lot of people out there haven't finished this book. It hasn't been out that long, and it's a bit of a beast lengthwise. So I can't really give you a bunch of examples about some of the things that he's ruined terribly through the course of his life. But in terms of balancing out a character, I think that's the key. If you have a character that's good at everything, it's not terribly believable. If you have a character that never makes any mistakes, in my opinion, that's not terribly believable either. And Quoth is good at a lot of things, but not everything. There's some things that he thinks he's good at, and he's really not. and he makes terrible mistakes all the time because he's human and because, you know, he's still a kid in a lot of ways. He's 16, 17 years old throughout the majority of the second book, and that's prime mistake-making time in your life. So I think that's the key to having a relatable character is to... you know, have them be kind of real, have them occasionally screw up. I mean, that's not new news. The ancient Greeks knew that. A hero was a great person with a flaw. And that's what Quoth is. He's really good at some stuff, and he's got his own personal flaws.
Tell me a little about the name Quoth. Where did that come from?
That's embarrassing. So many of the names I carefully constructed or I drew from old, you know, linguistic traditions, or I built brick by brick. I doodled the name Quoth on my notebook in geometry class back in high school. and it was just, I was like, I wonder what letters I can make without moving my elbow. And I was just wasting time. And then I looked at the letters. I'm like, huh, Quoth. That might be kind of a cool name. And it stuck with me. And then eventually when I was getting ready to do this story, I needed a name for the character. And I picked that one.
Did anyone ever give you any grief about that in the publishing world? It's really striking. I mean, once you know it, you remember it. But at first glance, you think,
Well, and, you know, I tried to address that. The very first line of the book that I initially wrote was, "My name is Quoth," pronounced nearly the same as Quoth, like Quoth the Raven. And I'm like, there, that should take care of anyone wondering how it's pronounced. Mm. But it really didn't work. A lot of people out there think of it as Quoth or Quothe or Quothy or something like that. But really, it's no skin off my nose. I don't doubt that I've mispronounced some characters' names in my head. And really, it's whatever makes you happy.
Well, we're talking this hour with Patrick Rothfuss. He's a Wisconsin native from Stevens Point, and we're talking about his new book. It's pretty recently out, and it hit the bestsellers list at number one in this past week. It's called The Wise Man's Fear, the sequel to The Name of the Wind. And we're happy to take your phone call this morning for Pat Rothfuss. Tell us about what your experience has been reading this novel and what you think it takes to make a strong, believable fantasy world, or basically anything else you'd like to ask, too, of an author you might love. Our number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, and our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you this Friday morning here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we're joined in studio by Patrick Rothfuss. He is the best-selling author of The Wise Man's Fear and The Name of the Wind. And we'll go back to phones now. We've got Bob joining us from Door County. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. Thanks for having this show.
Sure.
A quick plug for Door County. We've got 8 to 10 inches of snow on the ground.
I heard you guys got hit kind of hard there.
I haven't read fantasy since Dune years ago, but I got to admit your discussions got me interested in your book, so I'm going to check them out. But I was curious on the tours that you do. Seems like we've got a lot of authors in Wisconsin from smaller towns and smaller cities, and I'm wondering do you find that to be pretty true of most states, or are there more states that seem to have authors popping up?
You know, I think there is kind of a disproportionately large number of authors here in Wisconsin. Maybe it's just that you register a little bit more when I hear about them. But, you know, given how many people are in Wisconsin, especially in the sci-fi and fantasy community, we've got some real heavy hitters, and a lot of new up-and-comers are from Wisconsin. Scott Lynch, who came out a year before I did, made a huge splash with The Lies of Locke Lamora. Kevin Anderson is from Wisconsin. He has been writing the Dune prequels. Kevin has written, you know, everything in a bag of chips.
Neil Gaiman.
He's pretty close. He's definitely a Midwestern author here. So I think whatever it is about Wisconsin, I think it's easier to write in a small town. Why? Well, because it's quieter. you get a chance to, there's not maybe as much to do, not as much to pull you away from your desk. And that's the bigger issue in terms of, getting writing done is just, you have to sit your ass down and do it. And it's hard to do that maybe if you live in Seattle. And there's, you know, cool alternative theater happening every night of the week. In Stevens Point, our theater scene is a little slender, and so it's easier to stay home and write.
You know, it's interesting, on the outside, Wisconsin might not seem like a sexy place. You know, the place you fly over on your airplane, if people know about it, they know about cheese and Packers, which is all good, too, but Wisconsin is not exactly seen of as a hip makeup. But what do you say now that you're an ambassador for Wisconsin? What do you say to people about why Wisconsin is cool?
What's not to like? I mean, people always say, you know, when are you going to head out to, when are you going to move to New York? I'm like, God, do you know what the rent is like in New York? And do you know what the people are like in New York? That's not fair. I've got a lot of very good friends that live in New York, but you know, I live in Stevens Point. I can walk to the grocery store in 15 minutes. I can walk downtown in 15 minutes. I can walk to the university if I get a chance to teach a class. It's quiet. You know, I don't need to lock the door of my car, you know, when I leave it in the driveway. that's a nice place to live. Why wouldn't I want to be there? You don't need a rock and roll lifestyle to write interesting books or to tell interesting stories. And nobody has proven that better than Garrison Keillor. Hmm. Small towns are full of interesting stories.
And we'll go back to the phones. And thank you, Bob, for that call. I hope you enjoy the books. And Sean from Madison. Hi, Sean.
Good morning, Veronica. Good morning to your guests.
Hey.
Another predictably excellent show. I wanted to just come out with a perhaps slightly different voice. Again, going to give you some mad props, but I will tell you that I do not read fantasy. I have not read you. I did not know who you were, but I knew that it would be a good show. And I am a songwriter, and everything you're saying about the creative process, specifically as a new dad, which I'm also... it resonates so much. The creative process is a template, and everything you're saying about your experience as a fantasy author has applied, if not directly, certainly indirectly, in the life I've been struggling with for 20 years. And I just wanted to say thank you for sharing your insight on it. It's really marvelous, and it's a breath of fresh air to hear. I'm every man succeeding the way you deserve to succeed. In something that so many of us, whether it's songwriting or playwriting or fiction, struggle with on a daily basis. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you. I wish I could do music, but I don't. Actually, the main character in this book is a musician. And one of the things that let me know that I had done a good job writing is when I started to get fan mail from people saying, it's so nice to hear, it's so nice to finally have a book written about music by a musician who really knows what he's talking about. And I have to like kind of break the news to them. I'm like, wow, that's very flattering. I'm glad I kind of fooled you, but really I'm not a musician. I don't play an instrument. I think so much of the creative process is very similar. It doesn't matter if you're writing a novel or a screenplay. It doesn't matter if you're making music or movies. It's all storytelling. It's all performance. It's all kind of tied together in the creative process.
I said you're not a musician. Obviously, you're a writer, but you do have a lot of hobbies. And just to throw out a couple facts that I picked up on your website, you advise both the college feminists and the local fencing club, right?
Yep.
And you host symposia in your home.
Yeah, well, you know, it that sounds less impressive if you know that the word symposia actually means wine drinking party. So that's what we would do for the most part is I would invite people over and we would drink a little bit of wine. I wouldn't typically. Wine doesn't do much for me. But then we would talk about things. We would talk about, what is the nature of love? What is Buddhist compassion really like? I had some very interesting friends in college, and we would get together three, four, five, six of us and talk about whatever. Those were good times.
And do you still do that?
You know, a lot of the problem with living in a college town is that you meet really cool college people and then they graduate and they leave you.
That happens in Madison too.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Sean. We appreciate your call. And I just want to, before we get to the end of the hour, we have a bunch of people wondering about book signings that are coming up. Can you tell us about any?
Are those emails up there?
These are some emails.
Wow, okay. There's a lot of those. If I didn't come to your hometown, I am sorry. I don't have full executive control of my tour schedule. If I didn't come to your state, I'm sorry. There's just so many hours in the day and so many days in the year. Rest assured, I'm doing another one in Austin in April, doing another one in LA in April. I'll be posting up the details on Facebook and on my blog. You can find out there. I'll probably be doing one in Stevens Point fairly soon too. It's my hometown.
What about you've been in Madison already?
I did Madison on the 8th. Right now there's like a whole ton of signed copies over at the Easttown Barnes & Noble, because I swung through and they had like 50 copies of the book, so I signed them all. That was about a week ago. There's probably still some there if you really want one.
Great. Well, thank you. And then so stay posted to your blog and Facebook page, too. And let's take another call. Dan joins us from Lansing, Michigan. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
Hey, go ahead.
Well, Pat, the question I had is, from reading your blog, I know you don't have an extensive background in music yourself, and I was curious as to what made you choose that as a fairly large subject matter, and what made you decide upon the lute in particular.
Well, when I was getting ready to kind of create this character and tell a story, I didn't want him to be... I was trying to avoid writing the same copy of a copy of The Lord of the Rings that I read so much of growing up. Now, a lot of those books were great, and I very much enjoyed them, but I wanted to tell sort of a different story. And so I thought, what sort of a person really can have an interesting life in, you know, a legitimately pre-industrial world? And, I mean, musicians were huge. I mean, I read Casanova's memoirs a while back, and it's really interesting because these traveling players did things that nobody else would do. A lot of people, I mean, you lived in the same town your whole life. You maybe traveled 10, 15 miles, you know, but other than that, you pretty much stayed at home. But these people that came from out of town, these traveling musicians, they brought news, they brought entertainment. I mean, imagine living in a world with no radio, no television, no cable, no Xbox. I mean, you make your own fun for the most part, but then when a musician comes into town, this is an incredible person. This is like a rock star and Christmas all at the same time. And but at the same time, you know everyone in your town. You feel comfortable with them. They are your community. And this person is not part of that community. That makes them dangerous because you don't know how they're going to behave. And you know they're going to be gone in a couple of days. So what's to keep them from doing really terrible things? So these people were venerated and adored and loved and sought. And at the same time, they were really like kind of feared, and people were terribly jealous of them, and they were prosecuted and persecuted so often. And so that seemed like a really interesting thing to add to this character. Not just add to this character, it's the heart of what he is.
Well, thank you. Thank you for bringing that up, Dan. That's a great question. And I want to ask you about something I know you have some thoughts about: women in fantasy writing. And I remember when the Harry Potter books crested, and there were some op-ed pieces, at least one that I read, about people saying, Harry Potter should have been a girl. Here's J.K. Rowling. She's a woman writer writing fantasy. Why isn't she writing about a woman? And you look at the genre in general, and there are not a lot of female heroines out there. Why is that?
Boy, that's a question that is so big. You could teach an entire class on that. You could write a book on that, a series of books about that. But really, the big reason is probably tradition. Oh, are we having a fire alarm?
I can't believe it, but I think we might be. We'll see. No, I guess we're going to keep going. All right.
Extra drama for the show. We're staying. We're gonna finish this hour, even if it kills us.
Our director is still smiling, so I don't think it's a real fire drill.
But you know, there are. I think it's tradition again. You know, it's the same people write in the reason people write in third person. It's that most of the novels that they have read are in third person, and most of the main characters in books are male characters. And so you read that, you absorb that tradition, you absorb that trope. And then when you sit down to write your own book, that's kind of what you naturally fall into. We're kind of culturally saturated with it. And that's what's so dangerous about some of these underlying cultural beliefs, is we absorb them and then we perpetuate them without ever consciously engaging with them. And that's something that I try to be very careful of in my writing. We don't need more damsels in distress. That's not a useful thing.
Do you think we'll see more of that? I mean, I guess it could have something to do with the fact that so many fantasy writers are men, too. I mean, I can think of Anne McCaffrey as an alternative, but maybe just people write what they know. And if you're a man, that's what you know.
Well, and I think you're right. A lot of people do write what they know. And it's not that they know that they're men. It's that they know stories about men, because that's what we have so much of. But actually, you would be amazed how many authors are women. The entire publishing industry is very, I hesitate to say female dominated because that sounds kind of menacing, but, you know, most of the editors, most of the publishers, most of the PR people in publishing are women, and a lot of the authors are women, but up until recently, especially in sci-fi and fantasy, you changed your name so that it didn't look female, and so you could sell books. C.J. Cherry, who wrote, it writes just incredible stuff for the last 30 years, they changed her name to, it was Carolyn Cherry. And my editor's dad said, you're never going to sell a sci-fi novel with a name like Carolyn Cherry. So they changed it to C.J. Cherry.
Well, Patrick Rothfuss, I wish we had more time, but it's been fabulous to talk with you. Thank you so much, and thank you for not being alarmed at the fire drill.
Thanks for having me.
Patrick Rothfuss, our guest this morning, the author of The Wise Man's Fear and also The Name of the Wind. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.